Welcome to The Swing, Canadian political analysis for a global audience. I'm Yaroslav Baran. Today we've got the great pleasure of being joined by a special guest, Oz Vungich, who has just concluded a four-year term in the Prime Minister's office advising on foreign policy and the G7. Part exit interview and part, well, hey, let's just have a good discussion about what it was like, how things work in that pressure cooker environment, and fond recollections from such an important post. Thanks for joining us today, Oz.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me, Yaroslav.
You're no slouch, a real PhD in geopolitical conflict. You've lived on both sides of the pond. You served in PMO for 4 years, spanning two prime ministers, Justin Trudeau and the beginning of the Mark Carney government. You've seen a lot in that role, the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the crafting of Canada's response, the war in Gaza responding to the October 7th attacks against Israeli citizens by Hamas. You've witnessed a 180-degree shift in momentum and urgency to rebuild Canada's armed forces, a second Donald Trump presidency, and the global trade disruption that's ensued. So we're going to unpack a couple of those things, but first let me ask you, how does it feel to be out?
I have a sense of pride and satisfaction. I had four long, busy, and happy years. I did a lot of meaningful work with brilliant colleagues from whom I learned a lot. And of course, it was a great honor to serve my country in that capacity.
What are your most profound recollections from your tenure in that post? What's a moment you're going to share with your grandchildren someday?
Yeah, there were definitely a few moments when I could really pinch myself and when I realized that I was working a dream job for someone who had studied history and international relations and politics. I remember in 2022, there were a few such moments. I remember supporting Prime Minister Trudeau then at the NATO Leaders Summit, and it was an event that I'd done a lot of work for to help prepare him for that. And then I remember there was this moment when we were sitting with the team and the Prime Minister going through his remarks and kind of talking it through and making some edits before he delivered his speech in front of other NATO leaders. And I remember just thinking, this is unbelievable. And I felt so grateful to be able to work in that capacity at that moment.
Can you talk a bit about the relationship and interaction between your office, the policy brains at PMO, but at the end of the day, political staff, and the public service, most notably the Privy Council office? Now, the Prime Minister has a National Security and Intelligence Advisor, resident in PCO and at a deputy minister rank. And that role is the government liaison for inputs from numerous sources, Public Safety Canada, CSIS, the Armed Forces, Global Affairs, the Communication Security Establishment, RCMP, the Five Eyes, and so on. In the real world, how does PMO, the Prime Minister's office, and PCO, the Privy Council office, how do they work together on foreign policy files?
Yeah, so in the real world, PMO staff and PCO officials, who are truly dedicated and excellent public servants, work together to provide the best possible advice to the Prime Minister from the different perspectives. So when some development occurs, PMO staff will seek advice and options from PCO on what action or actions the government could take. So PCO will provide its advice, and then PMO will provide its on top of that. So in other words, there is distinct advice from both PMO staff and from PCO officials. Often PMO staff will agree with PCO. Other times PMO will disagree, but the Prime Minister will always see both sets of advice. So when there's some disagreement, it could be about timing or some element of implementation. In my experience, the PM is well served in those situations where there is a divergence in advice, because it can help identify key trade-offs based on those different perspectives from the officials and from political staff. And overall, often there are many concurrent files at play, so it can be quite a lot of work and frantic and overlapping. But I think establishing a strong working relationship between political staff and officials at that very senior level is critical. And even when there's let's say, creative disagreement, things often work out for the best for the principal.
So I'd like to ask you about a very specific issue, probably an unavoidable one, the war in Gaza. Canada, in concert with Great Britain, Australia, and Portugal, announced recognition of the state of Palestine. Other countries like France and Belgium followed suit the next day. And since then, the number of countries recognizing a Palestinian state has grown even larger. That was a seminal, shall we call it, hinge moment in contemporary Canadian foreign policy. Can you tell us about how that decision came together?
Okay, so first, since 1948, successive Canadian governments have supported a two-state solution. And the conduct of the conflict in Gaza and other recent actions in the region made the prospect of a Palestinian state seem more distant, and the prospect of a negotiated agreement between the two sides that could result in a Palestinian state seemed quite unlikely. So the decision emerged from a sense that Canada and other partners wanted to signal our enduring commitment to the idea, to the principle of two states living side by side in peace and dignity. And of course, that means confirming security for Israel. And our view, or at the time when I was at the Prime Minister's office, was that the best way to ensure long-term peace, as well as regional stability that includes normalization of relations between Israel and other nations in the region, is advancing a two-state solution, which means recognizing a Palestinian state. So that was the reasoning.
Yeah, but that recognition came with caveats, or did it? I mean, the Prime Minister said that it is contingent upon disarmament of Hamas, institutional reforms, elections next year without Hamas participation, you know, along with one or two other conditions. But on the other hand, it was not a conditional declaration of recognition per se. So how does the government of Canada offer a caveated recognition based on conditions that can only be fulfilled in the future? How does that work? And what was the thinking there?
Okay, so Hamas absolutely cannot have any role in the future governance of Palestine, full stop. It committed a heinous nightmare terror attack on civilians on October 7th, 2023. And even before then, Canada recognized it as a terror entity under our criminal code. That means Canadian institutions, by law, cannot have any dealings with it or its members. So in the lead up to Canada's recognition by Prime Minister Carney in September at the UN General Assembly, Canada received outlines of steps that the Palestinian Authority will take to reform itself and advance the building blocks of institutions that will lead to a functional state. So as Prime Minister Carney said, recognition is not a panacea. So in other words, there are many steps that need to occur for a Palestinian state to function in a manner that fulfills its duty, including security. So Canada and other partners will be there to support it in its capacity building. And as part of Canada's recognition, the Palestinian Authority has outlined its plans, which we've accepted in good faith, and we will support their implementation in the weeks, months, years, even decades to come.
Some of the criticism of Prime Minister Carney's move came notably from the official opposition conservatives, but also from Jewish groups in Canada. It was criticized as, quote unquote, rewarding Hamas or rewarding terrorism. And, you know, other lines of critique, I recall MPs in question period asking, what are the geographical boundaries of this Canada recognized state? And what is its capital? Or with whom specifically are we going to be exchanging diplomatic relations? So what's your response to those critiques?
So I'd underscore that many developments have occurred on the ground and also in the diplomatic arena since October 7th, 2023. You and your listeners may recall the outpouring of support for Israel following the terror attack, including, I remember, lighting Canadian Parliament in the colors of the Israeli flag. So in the last 2 years, the manner of the conduct of the conflict has made the possibility of a negotiated agreement between those two sides seem so unlikely that I think it's reasonable for Canada to have shifted its position to recognizing a Palestinian state now, rather than at the end of some process.
One more question on this point. On September 29th, U.S. President Trump announced his own solution in conjunction with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. He announced a peace plan to end the war. And it's a phased approach that includes first, ceasefire, hostage release by Hamas, prisoner return by Israel, Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, and the resumption of humanitarian relief. Later phases are meant to deal with security, disarmament, governance, reconstruction, political oversight, and eventually, potentially, maybe a pathway to eventual, potential, maybe statehood. Now, Prime Minister Carney was present last weekend for the signing ceremony, signaling presumably endorsement of that plan. Now, does this mean that the reality of the situation has already made Canada's declaration obsolete? Has it been overtaken by events? Like, how does it work in situations like that? Canada diplomatically declaring one thing, but then the reality on the ground, including global geopolitical momentum, going in a different direction.
So I don't see Canada's recognition and this very welcome peace process as incongruous at all. On the contrary, we may learn in a future memoir by a Trump administration official that decisions by Canada and others to recognize Palestine may have provided President Trump with an argument to advance the conclusion of the conflict. So why don't we check in on that one in a decade or two in a future episode of this podcast. But the point is, at the Egypt summit earlier this week, there were countries that have recognized the Palestinian state for a long time, some who have recently, including Canada, and others who have not, including the United States. But all those present have an interest and a commitment to peace.
Okay. Another ongoing and hot file, of course, is Russia's war against Ukraine. Canada has been a leader in unwavering support for Ukraine. The lower in the coalition of the willing in terms of material and military assistance, largely by virtue of Canada's size. And of course, this is a file that you and I collaborated on, given one of my hats as a director with the Canada-Ukraine Foundation. And by the way, I'd like to thank you for always being very responsive and constructive. What's your sense of how the international coalition has been evolving? Because I can tell you, there's a pretty big sense in Kyiv that if the international community had immediately given Ukraine all the support that it eventually came around to providing, the war would have been over a long time ago with the Ukrainian victory. So what was the perspective from the inside as all of that evolved?
Yeah, so I can assure you and your listeners that among G7 nations and NATO members, Canada's always advocated support for Ukraine, particularly since the full-scale invasion in February 2022. Canada's provided what we could, sought to purchase those things that we did not have, and encouraged others to provide support in forms Canada could not, by supplying certain kinds of equipment, for example. In fairness to some allies who took more time to come around, particularly in continental Europe, I'd say their closer proximity to the conflict raised the stakes for them. So I recognize that decisions to provide tanks or different kinds of weapons had a great significance that took some time and debate within their societies. I do think, though, and I hope that with the conclusion of the conflict in Gaza, ending the war in Ukraine may regain focus and momentum.
Thanks for joining us for a very interesting discussion, Oz. Before we go, are you going to tell our listeners what your next step is? There's been some buzz about you heading across the pond for your next gig. So is it still top secret, or are you ready for the big reveal?
I wouldn't say it's top secret, but yes, indeed, I'm moving to London in the United Kingdom. I'm going to start a role in the private sector, and I will reveal those details very shortly for those who may be interested.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks again for joining, and best of luck in your next move and your next endeavors, and don't be a stranger.
Thank you very much for having me, Yaroslav, and best wishes to your listeners.
Thanks.